Storytelling, like radio, brings pictures to the mind of the listener like you and allows each one of us to imagine what we hear. This week on Radio Curious, we visit with storyteller Mark Binder, author of A Hanukkah Present, 12 Tales to Give and Share. Mark Binder describes what happens when the storyteller vanishes. I spoke with him from his home in Providence, Rhode Island, on December 16, 2011. We began when I asked him to discuss the importance of storytelling around Hanukkah and other holidays of the winter season.
As I'm concerned, of telling stories around Hanukkah is the same reason you would tell stories at any other time of year, which is to bring people together and to share whatever culture you're part of. So if you're not Jewish and you want to share your own stories, or if you're not Jewish, maybe you want to read some of these stories in my book, because it's a way of communicating directly from person to person that doesn't necessarily happen if you just read things to yourself. I'm not a particularly religious person, so I don't actually tell or write any stories to promote a religious perspective. The stories that I write, for example, my Helm stories, I've written a lot of stories in the village of Helm, are not religious, except that the people in the stories are religious. So they're really written for anyone to enjoy, because I don't write just for Jewish people. I don't write just for young people. I was thinking just before I got on the air that my ideal reader would, the best way I could imagine somebody reading my Hanukkah book would be to be frying up latkes, potato pancakes, while your grandmother or your mother reads the stories to your kids, and your daughter is snuggled in next to her on one side, and your older son is on the other side, and the teenager is sitting across the room, and he puts down his cell phone and stops texting and listens. That would be my ideal scenario. And so stories communicate orally in the same way that radio does. It just connects you to the other person.
In the oral tradition that stories bring to voice, are there particular themes that you find repeated, whether they be stories of any one particular culture or perhaps not?
Well, I split my time as a writer and as a storyteller professionally. So I actually do a lot of telling stories to audiences of all ages. And for me, there's always a background element of joy that I try to infuse in my work. I do, from time to time, go for the lowest common denominator when I tell stories. I have two stories that use fart jokes that are just a lot of fun, because everybody gets those jokes, and some people frown and laugh, and some people smile and laugh. In a lot of my work, I've noticed that there are themes of poverty and a joyful life in spite of poverty. And that's something that I noticed really only after I'd been telling the stories for a while, but as we entered this recession, I noticed that those themes were there in a lot of the stories.
What would be an example of a story that makes the best out of a grim situation, in poverty as your example?
In my collection, A Hanukkah Present, there's a story called The Hanukkah Duck, which I wrote for my daughter. She was very young, and I'd been writing a lot of stories for the boys who are a little older. And so I wrote this story for my daughter, and it's about a duck. In the village of Helm, there's a cobbler, and he's a really good cobbler. He makes wonderful shoes, which means that if you buy a pair of his shoes, you don't need to buy another pair for years, which means he's very poor. So everyone else in the village has animals, but they don't have any. They can't afford even to keep animals. And one evening, during Hanukkah, a duck shows up at their house, and it's sort of a magical duck. And each time the duck tries to help them out, something else happens and gets in the way, until finally, you know, goodness and light prevail.
Well, Mark Binder, author of A Hanukkah Present, would you be able to read the story of the Hanukkah duck for us?
Sure, I'll read a little bit of it. Let me see if I can find it in the book. Here we go. The youngest was a girl, and she was the favorite. Her name was Faggy Shoshana, and everyone called her Little Bird. "Daddy, why don't we light the candles now?" Faggy asked on the first night of Hanukkah. "Everyone else in Chelm already has candles in their window." Her mother sighed. "Little Bird, we don't have any Hanukkah candles." "We have Sabbath candles. Can't we light them?" Esther Gold looked at her husband. Joshua Gold shrugged. "Why not?" So the whole family gathered around as the Hanukkah blessings were sung and the Sabbath candles were lit. "But what shall we do for candles for tomorrow night?" whispered Esther Gold to her husband. "And what will we do for candles for the Sabbath? Those were our last two." "Shh," he answered quietly. "We'll worry about that tomorrow. Look how happy they are." The two parents smiled together as they saw the faces of their children bathed in the warm glow of the candles. And it goes on. It's a nice story. I had forgotten that part. When I tell the story, that part, it's really interesting as a writer who tells stories. The spoken versions of my stories are not word-for-word readings. So parts of them drop out, and I had completely forgotten that part. I tell this story fairly often, and that hasn't been in it, and I really like that part. I may have to put it back into the spoken version.
The concept of that part is, let's celebrate with what we have today, and tomorrow something else will appear and allow us to celebrate with it.
Exactly, and that is what happens in this particular story. The duck shows up with a brass dreidel, which they then sell, and so on.
In preparing your collection of stories, A Hanukkah Present, being 12 stories to give and share, did you have an overall or a leading intention?
Well, these are stories that I've written over time. Every year, almost every year, I write a new Hanukkah story, and I send it out to friends, and I've sent them out to newspapers throughout the country, throughout the world, actually, they've been published. And as I was putting the collection together, it was interesting trying to shape it, because some of the stories came earlier than others, and some of the stories build on others, and then my publisher came to me and said, well, we've got these great stories, and we'd really like to make the first edition hardcover, but we don't have enough pages. Can you write something else? So I spent some time, and I wrote, there's a novella that finishes off the book that takes all of the characters and all of the stories in the book and ties them all together in an adventure. It's got a neat shape to it. I think it has a narrative arc. You can read each story individually. You don't have to read them in any particular order. But if you do read it front to back, you'll definitely get a feeling of a narrative arc.
Mark, many of the stories that you have concern food. Can you relate that to the story itself? Obviously, we all like to eat well, so I guess a story about good food would fit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a couple of things. The story of Hanukkah has in it a miracle surrounding oil. And so because of that, there is a permission given to eat anything that's fried. So potato latkes, potato pancakes, are very popular on Hanukkah. And there's a story of the lethal latkes in the book about these horrible potato pancakes. But one of the stories that I really like is a story that I like to tell on Fridays. It's called The Challah That Ate Chelm. And in the context of the story, the thing that it has to do with Hanukkah is because it's Hanukkah time and they add extra oil into the challah. But the story came because once I was making challah and I was working on a recipe. I didn't know how to bake at all. And I got a recipe from a baker and I didn't read it first. So I dumped into my KitchenAid mixer 6 cups of water, and then I started adding all the other ingredients in the flour. And if you've ever baked in a KitchenAid mixer, 6 cups of water is a lot of water. And the dough started to come out very quickly out of the mixer, and it went all over the counter. And the bread was delicious, and I cut the recipe down. But I came up with the idea of The Challah That Ate Chelm, which is a story of what happens when the baker's apprentice, who is a complete disaster, adds an entire bag of yeast because he forgot to order the flour. And it overwhelms the village.
How does it overwhelm the village? Can you fill us in?
what happens is, let me find it in the book and I'll read it to you, or I can tell it. Which would you prefer?
Why don't you read it to us?
Okay, here we go. Muddle the apprentice has mixed an entire bag of yeast into the bread dough, and then he went to sleep in the bakery, which is where he slept. And this is a moment later. What's he doing here? Said one voice. What's that thing pushing him down the street? Said another. Who cares? Said a third. Run! Muddle opened his eyes and was surprised to find himself rolling like a barrel down the middle of Helm's Main Street, with something pushing at his back every time he slowed. It's a dream, he thought, closing his eyes, until suddenly with a bump, Muddle hit a rock and was launched high into a tree. He grabbed onto a branch and hung on for dear life. Of course, by then he had reopened his eyes. What he saw was incredible. The main street of Helm was covered with a deep white goop. Villagers were cowering in doorways or peering out of windows. The ooze was growing and spreading and getting bigger still. From his perch, Muddle could see the goop seeping through the entire village. It seemed to be originating from the windows and doors of Reb Stein's bakery. This is a silly dream, Muddle thought. He reached over to pinch himself and fell right into the muck. It smelled like dough. It tasted like dough. That's when he realized it was no dream.
It was actually too much yeast.
It was too much yeast. It's a little bit of a tall tale.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Mark Binder from his home in Rhode Island, a favorite place in my personal history. Mark Binder is the author of A Hanukkah Present, 12 Tales to Give and Share. Mark Binder is also a performance storyteller rather than just a story writer. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Mark, in the role of a performance storyteller, how does that work for you, the dynamic between you as the teller and your audience, the listeners?
It's amazing to me, actually, because it's something that I never experienced until really about a dozen years ago. I had been working on my novel, The Brothers Schlemiel, which is also set in Helm, and I was writing the chapters week by week. It was being serialized in an old-fashioned way. And on Monday, I'd write an episode, and on Tuesday, I'd read it to someone, and on Wednesday, I would read it to someone else, and then I'd rewrite it and work on it. And I got invited to a storytelling group, and I would bring my chapter to them, and I'd read it to them, and they'd be like, oh, that's nice. And then after a while, they said, oh, you know, we really like that you're reading these stories, but why don't you try telling us a story? And I said, well, what's the difference? And then I tried it, and I found out there's a huge difference between an author reading a story from his text and someone telling a story to an audience. And there's a connection that happens, and it's very almost mystical in a really weird way. The storyteller vanishes, the audience vanishes, and all that's left is the story. And when that happens, it's just magical.
Can you give us some examples?
Actually, the other day I was in Berlin, New Hampshire, telling stories to a group of children. And I was telling them a story from the Hanukkah book, actually. There's a story called How Joseph Won His Bride with the Spin of a Dreidel. Joseph is a young boy. He's born during Hanukkah. He plays dreidel all the time. And when he's 17, he goes about winning money from everybody in the village, which causes fights and arguments, and finally he's brought before the merchant, and the merchant makes him a bet. He'll bet the hand of his daughter, his business, and his house on one spin at the dreidel. If Joseph loses, then Joseph has to give up his dreidels, give all the money back, and come to work for him. And Joseph is a dreidel shark. He can spin a dreidel, which is a four-sided top, and he can make it land on whatever he wants. He can bounce it off the walls, off the ceilings. Amazing. And I was telling the story to this auditorium full of kids, ranging and their teachers, ranging from third grade through sixth grade. And when I got to the part, they've cleared the table, and Reb Cantor and his wife and his daughter Leah and Joseph are all there, and everybody's leaning over the table, and Joseph took out his favorite dreidel, and he leaned in, and he gave it a spin, and it spun for 22 minutes. And when I said that, there were about three or four kids in the audience who went, oh! Because at the moment that I was saying it, they were there. They were watching this happen. And when I said, and the dreidel spun for 22 minutes, they saw it happen, you know, just in that moment. So 22 minutes happened in an instant, and they were all amazed. And that's just really cool.
To me, that's the essence of radio, because the listener, as I was, just as you were talking about the boys who said, I was envisioning those boys. Perhaps our listeners were as well.
Exactly.
And that does not happen with television.
Not so much, no, because television it gives you the visuals right there. And I guess the difference in terms of radio and live is that I get the feedback from the audience right away. There's an immediate sense of, wow, that's really working, or no, that's not working at all. We better do something better.
I think that's very true, because I find the intimacy of radio. Our listeners now are listening as, or perhaps eavesdropping, if they would characterize it that way, to your conversation and my response, your stories and my response, my questions. Our listeners now are listening to what we say back and forth and creating their own visual images based on their own personal experience, which in my opinion is what stories and radio do.
Exactly. And as somebody who works both in the literary and written word and in the spoken word, I find that for me, a lot of the difference is when I write something down, I give myself much more license to go into very detailed description. The descriptions of various things are much more detailed. When I speak a story, almost all of those are gone, and I allow the listener's imagination to do a lot of that. So, for example, one of the stories that I tell is the story of Jack and the Beanstalk, and I tell a pretty good version of it. In fact, at the end of the year, I change it over to Jack and the Christmas Tree, which, believe it or not, works really, really well. But when I tell the whole story, and if I'm before school and I'm taking questions afterwards, I said, did I tell you what Jack looked like, or what the giant looked like, or what his mother looked like? And I don't tell any of those details, and it allows people to have their own pictures in their heads rather than, you know, Jack was a skinny boy with brown hair and brown eyes and a big nose, which is another picture.
What sort of response did you get from people if you ask them what Jack looks like, absent your description?
The way they usually see it, it's easier with a different one, which is I talk about my older sister, Ellen, in a lot of my stories, and I say she's 2 years older than me, and people say, well, how old is Ellen? I said, how old do you think she is? And inevitably, she's either the same age as they are or 2 years older than they are.
Regardless of the age of the listener.
Regardless of the age of the listener. They could be, you know, 7 years old. They could be 15 years old. If they are adults, then they picture somebody in their teens.
Mark Binder, what drew you to be a storyteller?
It turned out that all of my training and my life lined up for this. I went to Columbia University in New York City, where I took classes in 22 departments. But ultimately, if you search through my transcripts, you'd find that I studied mythology. And I studied dance when I danced a lot when I was in New York. And then I came to Providence to go to the Trinity Rep Conservatory, where I studied playwriting and acting and directing. And then the second book I ever wrote was a collection called The Bedtime Storybook. And there was 100 stories in that book, all of my favorite stories and a lot of other ones that I found throughout the world. After these people introduced me to storytelling, when I stumbled upon it, I had all of the tools right there. I had 100 stories to pick from that I owned the copyright to. I had acting, writing, and directing training. I knew how to dance, and I had this entire background in mythology.
A one-man show.
Well, it's a many-person show because I vanish, and there are all these other characters running around on stage.
Through the personage of someone else?
No, just through the language. It is a one-man show in some ways.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on 4 different projects right now. The Bedtime Storybook 2 is something that's going to be coming out hopefully in the future. We just released a collection called Stories for Peace, Resolving Conflicts and Handling Bullies, which is based on a program that I do in schools. I studied Aikido, which is a martial art for peace, for many, many years, and we collected those in a book. So I'm working on promoting that book and getting that program into schools and communities and theaters and things like that. I'm working on a novel, and then I just wrote a piece the other day that I was invited to give a talk to the Visiting Nurses Association at their holiday party. And I had just seen Bill Irwin perform. Bill Irwin is a wonderful physical comedian and a clown. He was talking about old age. And so I wrote a short story for, as if Bill Irwin was in it, about an old man and a nurse. And I read that to them the other day. It was a neat experience.
Can you give us a piece of that?
This is the scene, it's toward the end of the story, when the old man has asked the nurse to help him up, and he sort of stops her and he stands up, and this is how it goes. He thought about collapsing back, about admitting defeat, but then he would not remember the last time. Then he would be done. Then he would be defeated and dead, just waiting for the breath to go from his body. So he took the breath and he felt his heart, and he listened to the music begin to play in his head, and he danced. She watched his feet move, at first uncertain whether he was trying to walk or trying to catch himself from falling. She leaned forward, but he held his hand up to keep her at bay. His right foot moved, his heel and his toe, his left foot moved, and then he danced. His body was old and out of practice and out of shape, but the muscles remembered familiar patterns and faint ideas. His blood rushed and his heart beat, eager to keep time with the rhythm, helping to fuel the fond and joyful movement that built and built and built and filled him with strength and the power of memory and the power of motion, not for any other purpose, but for its own sake and beauty. He danced a little, and she watched as time and age dropped away and were suspended. As he moved, he knew she was right, that women had lined up for him to dance anyway, and after that, who knew, because he moved with ease and authority and passion and love, and then it was gone. Not a sudden collapse, thankfully, but a final gesture of his left hand, and then a slow deflation from a young dancer back into the body of a frail old man.
He listened to the music play in his head and began to dance. I love that sentence.
Thank you.
At what age is a person old?
When they say so. I can't believe it. I'm going to be 50 next year, and I feel, I don't know, 35, 25. My eyes are telling the truth. But everything else is doing fine. So it's really, the old, you know, 65 is the new 45 thing. It really has to do with how you think of yourself and what you allow yourself to do and not do.
Have fun every day.
Might as well.
Well, there's nothing you can do tomorrow about not having had fun today.
True.
Well, Mark Binder, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about a eureka or an aha moment that has changed your life?
Absolutely. I was at a gathering of artists. This was a planning session that the City of Providence convened. When you put a whole bunch of artists together, actually probably if you put any profession together, they all complain. And they all complain about what isn't working and about the economy and about dwindling audiences. And I was sitting at the table with Barnaby Evans, who was the creator of Waterfire, which if you've never been to Providence, they take braziers and they build bonfires in the middle of the river, and tens of thousands of people show up to watch and listen to the music playing and watch the fires burning. It's very cool. And Barnaby is the most successful audience draw in Rhode Island. And I knew that what I do is not that. So what could I do? You know, I can't do spectacle in that way. I can't do a multiplicity of locations in that way. I can't have food in my, you know, that I give to people or sell to people. So what is it that I do that's different? And I clicked on the idea that the purpose of my work as a performer, as a storyteller, is to transmit joy. because I don't think you can get it any other way except person to person. You can get an edge of it on a phone call or in a radio broadcast. You can't get it from a TV or from a book, or you can enjoy yourself. But the experience of joy, I find it's something that one person creates or has that another person gets face to face. And I started to put that into every single performance that I do. And it's been phenomenal. I mean, it's just been, I don't have like, okay, right now I'm going to hit my joy mark. It's just a background intention. And it really has just helped me focus and gauge what I do. And it seems to work.
How do you manifest that background intention?
Very literally, it's in my preparation before I start. I just put it in my head that this is what I'm here for, and trust that the work that I do is going to do that. I mean, I enjoy my work. I think my work has lots and lots of moments of joy in it. For example, the story that I just read has that wonderful moment of suspension and joyful expression. If I was to perform that, I would have to really work hard to get that piece the way I want it to be. But then when I tell that story, I just trust that it's there and that the audience is going to experience it. And it seems to happen.
Well, Mark Binder, you may have just answered the next question, but what is it that you would like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I like to write and tell stories, and I like to make things like books and audio recordings. I have not done much in the way of video because I haven't found a way to communicate what I do in a visual sense, but I'd like to continue to write and tell stories before audiences and for people to read and to listen to, you know, and download and Kindle and all the other new things that are happening.
And finally, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Flann O'Brien wrote a book called The Best of Miles. Flann O'Brien was a pen name for Brian O'Nolan, who wrote a book called The Best of Miles, and Miles was a character in a column in the Irish Press. And he wrote volumes of stuff, and there's a collection called The Best of Miles. It's just a lot of fun to read.
Well, Mark Binder, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thanks very much for having me on the show. It's been a real pleasure.
Mark Binder is the author of A Hanukkah Present, 12 Tales to Give and Share. We visited by phone from his home in Providence, Rhode Island, on December 16, 2011. The book Mark Binder recommends is The Best of Miles by Flann O'Brien. You may find more information about Mark Binder at his website, Mark Binder, that's MarkBinder.com. All Radio Curious programs are free at our website, radiocurious.org. Our phone is 707-462-6541. Email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onestad is our associate producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.